This is gonna hurt.
It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
How do you define or quantify trust within your own family? Trust is a bond and promise that no matter what, you will always be safe. Trust is allowing a safe space to let your guard down and be yourself. Nobody ever tells a child to trust. They just do. Their instincts and innocence compels them to have the freedom to never question their environment. That beautiful vulnerability will remain until it's taken away. The broken trust of a child will never return once it's lost. Youth delivers a gift that some aren't worthy to receive. Loss of a child's trust may be the greatest crime humanity has ever seen. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Falaise, and welcome to the Suffering Podcast. If you're a fan of overcoming adversity and overcoming suffering, we're for you, because that's the stories we highlight and that's what we like to do here. So do me a favor, hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, please comment, ring the bell so you can get notified of all of our new content. Now you can join. Follow us on all social media so you can find out what we're up to. On this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we have a long, weary traveler coming a long way to sit down with us, and that's Sherry Alsop to discuss the suffering of incest. This is going to be a rough episode, but it's also a story that needs to be told and it needs to be heard. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's something that needs to be told.
Yes, it is. Before we get into any of the deep, dark stuff, let's throw a big shout out to our marquee sponsor. That's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody as police officers, but we do trust them. So go to ToyotaHackensack.com. Let them find you a car. They're all good guys over there.
And my father's car that he bought from Hackensack is still going.
Yeah, we just sent another one of our listeners over there, got another car. So they're doing okay.
He's 87. He doesn't know how to roll down the windows, but the car is still treating him right.
So, Sherry, each week we take a question from one of our audience members. This one comes from Rola15. How do you reconcile with yourself letting out your personal story in public? You have told your story many times. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's a difficult story. And you have to go home and put your head on the pillow and look at yourself in the mirror. How do you reconcile telling your personal business with yourself?
I think the hardest part was learning to not sugarcoat my story, because for so long I sugarcoated it to make other people like you guys not uncomfortable. And I realized by sugarcoating, I was doing a horrible injustice, not only to me, but to anybody that wants to learn about sexual assault and abuse and incest and trauma and all that goes with it. So for me, it was learning to not sugarcoat, not make it pretty. You can't make it pretty. So I just had to learn to just be real and just let it out there if I wanted to help other people.
And the first time you told it, I'm sure there was some little bit of hesitation in you.
A little trepidation.
Yeah.
Oh, it started much differently than I tell it now.
Really?
I told it very cautiously, very protective of other people, very sugarcoated, because I didn't want to offend anyone by telling them my stories. I didn't want to upset anybody. But I've learned now, especially since I work with law enforcement, that I don't have to do that.
Not with
us. And that's why I love law enforcement. I can just let it go. Just this is it. And I don't have to sugarcoat it. And this is my story.
Mike, what do you think? You've told your story several times. And how do you put your head on the pillow at night?
You know, you like you said, once you get it into your mind that your story is going to help someone else, it becomes a lot easier to talk about. You know, in the beginning, like you said, I was sugarcoating it. I didn't want to talk about it. You didn't want to be perceived as that person, you know. But once you realize that, because when you're going through that hell, you think you're the only one going through it.
Absolutely.
You know, but then you start to realize other people have gone through that, and your story and how you came through that story could wind up helping other people.
A lot of it comes from who your audience is as well. I know it's not the first time you told your story, but publicly, when he came on in episode 9, and that's sort of how this partnership happened. He also knew that I knew the story because I had been in group therapy with him, but he also knew that I understood his story. So when I'm telling somebody in the beginning, anyway, when I'm telling somebody who didn't understand, I was very, very hesitant.
Because you're afraid to tell people your story that haven't gone through.
Right.
Something similar to you.
Because they're going to judge you.
They're going to judge
you. They don't understand.
Exactly. Yeah. But once you kick that to the curb and say, you know what? As long as my story is helping people, then I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm.
Early on in this show, I had some people chiming in, some friends of mine. They're like, you got to change the name of the show. There's that word suffering.
It's a visceral word.
Exactly. This is exactly where I'm going. I made it sort of purposely, but sort of not purposely. Suffering has always had a very negative connotation.
Right.
Until you get through your suffering and you can flip it upside down, it actually becomes a strength. I took that suggestion and I said, no, I'm not changing it. I want it to be that way because people need to hear that stuff. The more you whitewash something, the more you perpetuate the same problems of silence.
100%.
So when I go out and I speak, or if I'm on a show and I speak and I talk about suicide, I've been asked several times recently to not use that word. And I said, you know what? And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And I said, you know what? I am going to say that word. Number one, it's part of my story. No, the more we say it, the more it gets out there. I'm not going to use traumatic event. I'm not going to use what else did they
There's another one that's new.
Yeah, it's traumatic.
Unlifed.
It's suicide. It's suicide.
I wanted to unlife myself.
Yeah, it's crazy.
No, so, it's suicide. Unalive.
Unalive.
Yes.
There you go.
Unalived myself, which is ridiculous to me. Because all we're doing is we're whitewashing a problem, and that silence has been the nexus of where this problem has always met the rubber meets the road, so forth.
Is unalive myself like the political correct way of saying it now? I mean, are we going down that road?
I've never heard that, but
it is what it is.
And I don't know if they think that softens it and makes it less. But listen, when you're in your kitchen floor trying to kill yourself, it doesn't matter what you want to call it.
Yeah.
Call it what you want. It's suicide.
The cops show up. Did you try to commit suicide? No, I tried to unalive myself.
But the same way with the show and the same way with when I use that word suicide, I want you to feel that. It is an uncomfortable feeling. I want you to. So you look at it this way. Any great piece of work throughout history, whether it's a play, a piece of literature, or a piece of art, it invokes an emotion. Mm-hmm. The word incest evokes an emotion. The word suicide evokes an emotion. The word shooting evokes an emotion. And that's one of the things that we need to do. We need to invoke that emotion to let people know that this is real. This isn't, you know, Mike said earlier that, you know, he doesn't like fake people. Well, this is as real as it gets, people. You know, and I will never silence that. And that doesn't say I'm not kind of people's feelings. I am. I'm kind of people's feelings. But the word that I hate, and I hate it, is the word triggered. Oh, my God, do I hate that word.
But we use it a lot, too, don't we?
I try not to. I have. Yeah. It recently came to my attention that, like, you know, somebody was saying triggered. And I said, how would you like it if I used the C word? This is a female I was talking to. How'd you like it if I used the C word to refer to another female? And they're like, wow, it's really bad. And I said, that's what that word does to me. That word actually triggers me. Because guess what? That when people become quote unquote triggered, it's because they haven't dealt with something. And I'm getting it out there. I'm putting it out on the table. Let's put our cards on the table. Let's deal with this stuff. So that's that type of emotion doesn't happen. Or when it does happen, it's a familiar experience and you know how to deal with it.
And I feel like if I'm telling you my story, and you tell me I've triggered you, then you're shutting me down. Because now your emotions are my responsibility.
That's a good point.
And I have to stop talking because I don't want to offend you.
Yeah, well, you're on the wrong show if you don't want to offend people.
And that's where the whitewashing comes in again. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I refuse to do it. I refuse to do it because Mike and I are here to change certain things. You're here to change certain things. And if we stay silent, that means we're complicit.
Then things stay the same.
So Rola 15, thank you very much for sending in that question. Keep sending in your questions and we will try to get them on the air. So Sherry, where did you fly in from? I don't even know where you flew in from. I swear to you, and this is a big mistake on my part.
Corpus Christi, Texas.
All the way out. See, you're in the land of the free. The home of Selena Quintanilla.
And Farrah Fawcett.
Oh. I didn't know Farrah Fawcett was from mm-hmm. Corpus Christi.
Hey, now.
No kidding.
I had a poster on my wall when I was a kid.
Who didn't?
Yeah.
I still see that what did they used to call that hairstyle?
Feathered, I think.
Feathered, yeah. Yes. I still see that. Every once in a while, you'll see somebody walk with a feather. I'm like, wow, okay. You know, that young boy comes out in me and get a little, like, all right.
Well, that was
get a little flush.
Farrah came out in like our molding phase of our lives. We'll keep it at that.
Yeah, but the poor girl died of butt cancer, though. I mean.
I know.
That's a bad way to go out. But, hey, listen, you know, after the burning bed, I had a whole new respect for her.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell, did you grow up in Texas?
I did not. I grew up in a little rural town in Kansas, between there and Alaska, back and forth.
Alaska. You know what? You might be one of the first people I ever met that actually spent any long period of time in Alaska.
I lived in Fairbanks and I lived in Anchorage multiple times. So I moved, my father drilled oil, and to drill oil in Alaska, you have to only drill in the wintertime because the ground has to be frozen. So sometimes we would go home in the summertime and sometimes we would stay in Alaska. So I was moved constantly, which just added to my already upheavaled childhood by never being in a place where I could develop
roots
and friendships and become close with a teacher or anything like that, because that never happened in my life.
Well, how frequent were the moves?
I probably moved, the last time I moved was in the eighth grade, and I probably moved 10 times.
And now you're in your formative years where you're trying to figure out what your identity is.
Yes.
And make friends.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's been that's hard when you live the life I lived, to try to make friends, because I spent 50 years just trying to find Sherry. So, and she's not who people thought she was.
Did you ever find her?
Yes, I did. And she has a loud mouth.
I just found her out in the hallway before.
That's a really loud mouth.
Well, you know, sometimes you got to speak up a little bit in order to be heard. So which one do you like better, Alaska or Kansas?
Alaska's beautiful. Very beautiful. Kansas is home. I still have a home in Kansas City. So Kansas City's home.
It's so flat. It's crazy flat. You know, I know everybody says the Great Plains and everything like that. You don't really understand it until you're like, yeah, it's just nothing. It's flat.
All right. You're from Kansas City. What are you doing Sunday?
Let's see. I feel like there's something going on.
Well, this will come out long after the Super Bowl.
So we can lament Kansas City's loss.
No. Wow.
She's got another place in San Francisco, too. So she's.
I'm going to be honest with you. Don't like Mahomes, but I'm an Eagles fan. So Travis Kelce's on the team. You know, and I know Jason's going to be there.
Jason's so funny.
He's the best.
He's funny.
Who else goes to the Super Bowl parade dressed as a mummer? And
yeah,
nobody around here really knows what mummers are. Mummers are just Italian guys that dress up like clowns and then do the same dance up down the street in Philly.
The podcasts that he and Travis have are so funny.
They are hysterical together.
Yes, together they are great.
Well, you know, it's pretty cool, and it's because you watch them, and if you ever watch that documentary Kelce on Amazon Prime.
I have not.
It's wonderful. It actually follows Jason last year because they thought he was going to retire, so they sort of followed him.
Is he?
He is
retired now.
I keep seeing things that make me think he's not.
He's an old timer. He's 36 years old, and
they throw enough money at him. He's coming back next year.
He's the best center I've ever seen, but it really endears you to the brotherly love and support that they give one another.
And the motherly love when her mother comes down on the field too. I mean, you know, when they play in the Super Bowl against each other. Yeah. The mother was right there. She had the jersey split in half and went up to both kids. And
it's amazing to watch. And you learn how much Jason has protected Travis, because Travis went, I forget where they went to college, but Travis got thrown out because he got caught with, I think, weed or something like that. And Jason stepped up, who was playing on the same team, stepped up and says, hey, just give him another shot. Come on. And he coerced the coach in order to give him another shot. And the rest is history.
Yeah, it's a great story. And their mom is just. I mean, she bakes chocolate chip cookies and takes them to the games.
Feeds them chunky soup.
That's great.
So that's interesting. I have been through Kansas, and you know, you go over a little undulation in the road, and you just see forever. Mm-hmm. You know, but I was wondering where Dorothy's house was.
I never wanted to go to Kansas because I saw what happened to Dorothy and Toto, so I never wanted to go there.
I don't know. Again, tornadoes. I've been in one tornado. I'm not a fan.
It's funny because I live in Corpus now and they have hurricanes and people just absolutely lose their mind when there's a hurricane coming. And I've been through one, so I get that. But they have like a week. And I say, you guys need to come to Kansas. We have tornadoes and you get like a 30-second warning. So, you know, we don't have time to go out and prepare and do all the things you do in a hurricane. But
then you have earthquakes. Did you have earthquakes? They have earthquakes in Alaska, mm-hmm. right? Have you ever been in an earthquake?
Yeah, minor. The little New Jersey earthquake that we had.
San Diego was in one. And yeah, that's you want to talk about helpless. There's nothing you can do.
Just watch your things fall out of the cabinets.
And just stand in a doorway.
Stand in a doorway is what they always said.
Yeah, you go back to that thing. Oh, I guess I'm going to stand in a doorway. Well, I'm on the sixth floor of a building. It doesn't make a difference. You know, they're going to find a doorway that smashed a guy. That's pretty much what they're going
to
find.
Did you guys have to get under your desk? In Alaska, we had earthquake drills like you do a tornado drill, and we had to get underneath our desk.
Oh,
that,
wow.
That was what was going to save you.
Yeah.
So we brought you here to talk about something very, very, very serious because, and it's a topic that is not going to be very popular. We've had some discussions. We're probably going to take some hits on it, but you know what? I don't give a shit.
It's a story that needs to be told.
I don't give a shit.
We say this all the time. We're not here for the money. We want to take a hit on it. We're going to take a hit on it because Kevin and I feel that these are stories that need to get out.
That says a lot about you guys.
We're not in it for the money. We're in it to help people.
We are grateful for the sponsors that we have that keep the lights on. Toyota, Cubita Cafe, the Oakley Kitchen, they keep the lights on. And that's all we want to do is keep furthering the message. But we're here to talk about the suffering of incest. And this is odd. I'm going to tell you right now that it's ominous to me. I might be triggered. I had to break that tension a little bit. I might be triggered.
I'm going to thump you in the forehead if you are.
I'm one of the guys that breaks the tension.
I had to, man.
You do the interviews. I'll break the tension. How the hell am I going to? I got a bunch of things in my mind.
He's on it.
How the hell am I going to sit here and talk about it? I'm going to let you go.
I was just going to say, I'll start.
I'm going to let you go.
Why don't you interview us?
Yeah.
Okay. I was trying to decide where in my life do I want to jump in? I think.
When's the first time? When's the first time you experienced this? Let's start.
I was going to say, I think that's going to be where I'm going to start. Now, when I'm working with law enforcement or whoever I'm working with, my very first picture on my PowerPoint is a picture of a little girl that's 7. And it's really important for me that people recognize that as I'm walking you through my story, I'm not telling you the decisions that I made and the survival techniques that I used. I didn't make with this brain. And that's so important because people look at me now and say, you shoulda, coulda, woulda. Well, yeah, now I shoulda, coulda, woulda.
Yeah.
But she was 7. So that's what's on my PowerPoint to begin with, a picture of me when I'm 7. And I tell people, if you want to judge me, you can't look at me and judge me. You have to look at her. She made the decisions. She made the survival techniques. She lived through it.
What kind of mental capabilities do you really have at 7 years?
Exactly.
Years
old? Yeah, none. And that's
there's no coulda, shoulda, what is it? 7?
No. And that's why it's so important for me that people, they can't look at me now. They have to look at her. And we're... That makes me sound like I have a split personality, but I need them to look at the PowerPoint. I need them to concentrate on that child's picture when I'm telling them my story. So my first memory, I was about 7. Now, my first memory is full penetration, not typical for a perpetrator. So my longtime therapist believes that there was a period before that. I don't have that. It may come and it may not. I still get things that come back. May come and it may not. But my parents were married. I have 3 siblings. There are 3 of us. I'm the oldest. I have a sister 2 years younger than me and a brother that's 9 years younger than me. But people say to me, you shoulda, coulda, woulda, or whatever. But what I like for people to understand, and anybody that's watching, because if you're a survivor of incest, you're filled with guilt, shame, and humiliation. That's all we know. Guilt, shame, and humiliation. So what I educate people on is how a perpetrator works. Now, you guys may very well have an insight to how perpetrators work. A perpetrator on this side of your brain, they tell you who you are, who I am. over and over every day, every day. My father told me that I was stupid and fat and dumb and worthless, and I would never amount to anything. That every day, every day, every day. So on this side of my brain, I know who I am because I'm fed this every day. And on this side of my brain, he's telling me what's going to happen if I tell somebody. My mother's going to cry, and that's going to be my fault. My parents will get a divorce, and that's my fault. My father will lose his job, and that's my fault. We'll be homeless, and that's going to be my fault. I'll be put in foster care, and that'll be my fault. So everything in the world that's going to happen to me and my family because of my father's actions are going to be my fault. So that's how a perpetrator works. When people don't understand, well, why didn't you just fill in the blank?
Why didn't you just tell somebody? Why didn't you just do this? Why didn't, yeah.
Well, it's grooming, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I grew up in the 70s. We don't talk about sexual assault now. We sure weren't talking about it in the 70s. I still cannot get into colleges to talk about it. And sexual assault on a college campus is rampant, but we can't talk about it because it makes people uncomfortable. So we're not talking about it now. We dang sure weren't talking about it then. But it was not once, and once is horrific. It was not monthly. It was not weekly. It was almost daily. Now, my father, I told you, drilled oil in Alaska. So in the summertime, my father didn't work. My mom did, but my father didn't. Last day of school every year was my worst day of my life because I knew I was going to be home all summer with my father. So
Can I ask you a question? There's some questions that I have popping up. Was it a violent assault? Was it a duty? Like I'm trying to get into that 7-year-old's mind where I'm scared. If I don't just sit here and comply, am I going to get hit? Was it you? Well, Dad wants this again. It was your father, correct?
Correct.
All right. Dad wants this again, and I'm the vessel. I just have to, this is my job.
Like you said, I think duty is the correct word. Like, did you feel it was your duty?
Well, my father was a very violent man in every way, physically, mentally, verbally, emotionally, every gamut. My father was a horrific man. Now, I want you to know that the community, when you ask the community about my dad's a great guy, as most perpetrators are. A really great guy. Now, society likes things packaged up because we can take them better. And so they like to believe that a perpetrator, you know, rolls up beside you in a white van and says, hey, little girl, do you want some candy? But that's not the truth.
That's Hollywood.
Yes. And the public can, it's palatable that way. We can take that and digest it. But 85% of all victims know their perpetrator. So it's not the way society likes to believe that it is. But I think the main answer to that is I had a sister 2 years younger than me. And it was my job that I gave myself to protect my sister. And I knew I had to do that. Now, the other side to that is I was terrified of my father. I had been beaten many, many times by him. He was a horrible man. So I knew what would happen. And the thought of saying no wasn't even on the table. Never.
Because you just got beat.
Oh, yeah.
So you just had to lay there and take it.
Yeah. There was no interaction. There was no. And he was so blatant. There were times when my mom worked. I could hear her car in the driveway. She'd be leaving for work. And my father would be in my room. And my mom's car was still in the driveway. And I always thought if my mom would just forget her cigarettes or forget her coffee or forget her whatever and come back, then she would see what was happening. She would gather my siblings and I up, and we would move far away to this magical place where there's no, where people aren't harmed and terrific things aren't happening. And there's happily ever after. But that never happened. And
so you wanted to move to like Disney World?
Anywhere. I wanted to move anywhere. You know, when I lived in Alaska, there was this huge, in Anchorage, there's this huge hotel, and it's where they had the ritzy Christmas parties. And that was in my brain. That was where I would, that was where I could go.
So you were able to totally detach yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you have any conscious thoughts while the act was happening?
Mm-mm. No, total detachment.
Wow.
As a survival mechanism.
I guess you have to do that mm-hmm. to make sense. But it's even at 7 years old. I'm fairly certain that you knew what was going on wasn't correct.
It was horrible. And to this day, I'm a compulsive hand washer. So, and it's been, I'm 62 And I'm still compulsively washing my hands to get them clean. So I don't do it nearly as much as I used to, but that's...
Is that like subconsciously washing the dirt off you?
Mm-hmm. Still trying to get that off of me. There were times he would make me put a certain lotion on my hands. And so I'm still, you know, if I'm still for a second, I can still feel that and smell that smell and look in my brain. I don't know that they even sell it anymore. I can still see the label and stuff.
Well, it's amazing that the olfactory senses, how much they trigger. You notice how I worked that word in. How they trigger memories, like
with me and you, to smell of gunpowder, to smell of burning tires.
From my childhood, Murphy's oil soap. Do you know Murphy? They use it for cleaning stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My mother used to clean with that, and I did not like where I grew up. And I remember telling my wife very early on, I'm like, if you ever buy Murphy's oil soap, I will throw it out of the house violently as far as I can. And it's just it. Makes me snap like that. So lotion must do something mm-hmm. similar, especially a scent.
And I'm trying very hard now to remember the name of it, and I can't, which is funny because it's one of those things I've tried to forget and it's finally gone.
But now that you forgot it, you want to remember it.
I can't remember what it is. But when I work with law enforcement, that's what I try desperately to get them to understand is I know you want us to give you the who, what, where, when, and why, and start at the beginning and take it to the end, but we can't do that. But ask me what I smelled. I'll tell you. Ask me what I heard. Ask me what I felt. I could feel grass. Oh, so you were outside. Or I could feel dirty carpet or whatever. We know. We know the senses. Ask me those things. And I can help you as a victim. I mean, I'm not a victim now.
I'm trying to paint a picture. Your father walks into your room. Does he say anything?
Oh, no.
He doesn't say anything.
No, there's no conversation.
And do you recall
lots of groping?
Do you recall the first time that he did it? What he said is like, this is what's going to happen now.
One of the things in being told who I was all the time and dumb and stupid. One of the things that he often said to me during the times that he was in my room was that I needed to be really good at giving a blowjob because that's how I could make a living. That was the bar that was set for me.
At 7 years old, your father is making you do that to him.
Mm-hmm.
What is fucking wrong with this world?
Yeah, no kidding. I'm just sitting there. Where are we going to go with this now?
Because I have children. Mike has children. And it's the only two people in the world. There's three people in the world that I would murder for. My children, my wife. I'd murder you for them. and so they never have to feel anything even like this. And I'm trying to get into your, I really don't want to do that because what your father's thought process on why he would do that to his daughter.
To his own daughter.
For God's sakes, it's your blood. It's somebody who comes from you, and you're treating it like a toy.
It's got to be some sort of demented individual.
It has to be. And I have people say to me, "Well, your father must have gone through something." Don't know. Don't care.
We have learned this through Clark Fredericks, who is a child, a victim of childhood rape. We have learned this that because that's a question I asked him. His abuser, a guy named Dennis Pegg. I said, "Well, what are the chances that he was molested as a child?" And what he had learned through his travels and through his therapy, that is a very skewed fact that's put out. It's put out as fact. Not all people who molest were molested.
I certainly haven't harmed my children. I can tell you that. Yeah, and exactly. I would go to jail if I thought anybody did.
Oh, 100%. So I don't know if you're following the whole thing of the Cain Velasquez story out in L.A. Cain Velasquez is a UFC fighter, probably pound for pound, one of the greatest heavyweights that ever lived in the UFC. So his child was going to daycare, and he found out the daycare teacher molested him. I don't know whether they penetrated, but I think there was some molesting going on. And when Cain Velasquez found out, he drove down there, he got in his car, He chased the guy out. The guy got in his car and started running, and he's driving down the road and he's shooting a gun at him. Right? Every father in the world went,
there you go. Good job.
Great job.
Love it.
Cain Velasquez gets arrested. So does this guy. The guy makes bail before Cain Velasquez. There's something fundamentally wrong.
Hey, you know, the other question I have people ask me is, how do I feel about jail time and rehabilitation for perpetrators? No. I used to think if you could take a butter knife and castrate them, maybe they would stop. But it's not about sex. It's not.
It's about power.
It's about power and control.
Yep, absolutely.
And so it doesn't matter. You can't rehabilitate the need for power and control. You just can't.
I'm just trying to figure out what he saw, how that happened. And I you know what? There's some people who are just broken. They got that bent gene in them that they need that, or, you know, maybe they don't feel okay with themselves. And by doing this makes them feel okay with themselves.
It's got to be an insecure person to try to boost their own ego. You know what I'm saying? Hey, look what I'm doing.
And it all goes back to power and control.
Yeah.
But so as a 7-year-old child, you're getting this on a daily basis.
Not daily, but
frequent.
Yes. More than once a week.
Frequent enough.
More than once a week. Mm-hmm. And you're living your life like this, trying to go to school. Putting a face. So at that time, this obviously went on for years, mm-hmm. correct? So how did your trauma present itself to the outside world?
I was very quiet, very shy, very withdrawn. I got poor grades in school. No one asked why. My learning is awful. The way that I learn is awful because my brain is so broken. But because I was so, I always thought in my tiny broken brain that if I could be quiet enough or tiny enough or still enough or thin enough or whatever the enough was, that he would forget I was there and maybe it would stop. So I just became, which is, we talked about posture, and I just tried to be just this invisible person and hoping that people would forget I was there. So I spent my life trying to be forgotten.
But see, and you bounced around too, so you had nobody to really confide in.
Right.
You know, you had no friends or no teachers.
No long-term best friend.
You were bouncing around from here to there.
Which made it even more detrimental because there was nobody I could have gone to.
I mean, even if you stayed in like one school, maybe one of the teachers would have picked up on that.
Perhaps, because the town in Kansas that I lived in was a very small town of about 3,000 people. So maybe, but I was never anywhere long enough for anybody to really get to know me. And so I just did my best to become invisible and truly invisible. I didn't ever raise my hand in class to answer a question. I couldn't read out loud. I couldn't do anything that brought any attention to me. No.
What do you think the purpose of that was?
Oh, I just wanted to be invisible and forgotten. I didn't want to be seen. I didn't want, and certainly no one heard me. I didn't have a voice.
And your mother didn't notice anything. Was she comfortably ignorant?
Don't know.
You know, like what I was going to say is like sitting around the dinner table when everybody's there, you know, you, your father, your mother, sister and brother. Mm-hmm. It had to be an awkward. I mean, he never showed signs of like.
Oh, he was violent all the time. Violent outburst.
That's how he controlled everyone.
Right. Yeah. And if you at our dinner table, if somebody spilled a glass of water, he would jump up from the table and flip the table upside down, and glasses and dishes and food would scatter. And
he's not here because Andrew spilled that water before over here.
And I didn't see Andrew spill that. But I'm just now, just in the last couple of years, if I'm anywhere and I spill my glass of water, I'm just like, everybody take cover because all hell's about to break loose. And I'm working on really, really hard on getting grounded, getting my feet on the ground, touching somebody it's okay. You know, I'm not 12, I'm not 10, the world's not about to end. It's just a glass of water. It's all good.
So you had two younger siblings. Mm-hmm. Okay. Both girls?
Brother and a sister.
Brother and a sister. Was your father's view of your brother a little different than the girls?
Mm-hmm.
Was that his, like,
yes,
his favorite?
I don't know. He wasn't violent with your brother.
Yes, some, not as drastic, not as much.
And how about your little sister at this time? Was she ever?
She was a little more braver. I think she was braver than me. She had a mouth on her, and I didn't. I just.
Well, now you said your sister was 2 years younger than you, right? So you're kind of in the same age group. Did you ever confide in her or anything like that? Or
not until I was 35. She was the first person that I told.
And what was her reaction?
Shock.
So she had obviously never experienced what you were experiencing.
I don't know.
You don't know.
I have my
suspicions.
Mm-hmm. But together we told my mom, and when I was 35, nobody knew. Nobody, not my children's father that I was married to. Nobody. And my mom confronted my father, and he said, "It's true. Everything they're telling you is true." And I was so elated because I knew that my mom was going to leave him and I was going to get to have a relationship with my mom, and that happily ever after was finally within my reach, finally. And my mom left him. And the next day she called me and said, "I just want you to know I talked to your dad and he said he's sorry and I'm going home." And she did. And they stayed together until he died about 10 years ago.
Holy cow.
And happy day in your life when he died, huh?
Well,
the fact that she chose to stay was such a devastating blow.
I'm sure.
It's a kick in the pants after what you went through. Now, how long, you're talking seven till when?
Well, I got married when I was in high school, a senior in high school, so I was 17.
Was that just to get, did you get married just to get away?
Mm-hmm.
So it had been going on the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So I didn't play sports. I didn't have friends over. I couldn't have friends over. I didn't know if it was safe for them. My job in the whole world was to protect everyone around me.
Unfortunately, the person that needed the protection the most.
Yeah. Was the one that was doing the protecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't that often the way?
Yeah. I wouldn't have friends over because I didn't know if he would touch them.
The people trying to give those around them a little bit of peace when they're in pieces.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you grow up, you start to become a very young woman. Did it ever once, did you try to tell anybody? Maybe you got to the door and you just couldn't walk through. Mm-hmm. Total silence.
No, it was so far boxed up in the back of my brain that, no, I didn't. I just had this. I could be whoever I needed to be. If you want me to be the PTA mom, I can be that. If you want me to be the little league mom that brings the treats, I can do that. Whatever, you just tell me what you want me to do, who you want me to be, and I can be it.
No. And forgive me if I'm stepping over, but when you got married, and you had like sexual relations with your husband, was. Mm-hmm.
Very, very difficult.
I was going to say, it's going to be tough.
Well, so going back, the first time that you ever had sex, and please, if I'm going too far, tell me, cut the shit.
Your shit's all right now.
Okay. The first time you have a mutual sexual relationship with somebody had consensual. To blow consent. Yeah. Consensual yeah. sexual relationship had to blow your mind.
I was so numb to everything in life that It was numb.
Was it, at what age did you finally have a consensual sexual experience?
17 when I got married.
17 when, so real, you know, because I had heard through research that children who experience sexual abuse very young often become promiscuous. You went the opposite.
Right. I think you go one of two ways. I think you either become very promiscuous and try to take some sort of control back of your life, or you just.
Shut down.
Just, yeah.
I mean, you talk to most prostitutes on the street and they'll say they were sexually abused as children. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's where I get that from. And it's out of ignorance. It's not out of disrespect.
No, it's not ignorance at all. And a lot of it goes back to the grooming. We know who we are. We're dumb, stupid, worthless, and we better be able to give a damn good blowjob. We know who we are. We've been told it our whole lives. So I get those ladies. I get it. I mean, I've never done it, but that doesn't mean I'm better than them. I understand it. It's an act that's emotionless. You detach from it. You get your money and you go.
And never once telling your father, what are you doing?
Never.
That is very strange to the way my mind works. I at some point children rebel in whatever form or fashion that they rebel. I would do it, but you know, at some point it's enough where you fight back a little bit, I guess.
I took enough beatings for other things that one, it was easier and it passed quicker to just be still.
So you just wanted it over.
Yes.
You knew it was going to happen. You just wanted it over and get on with the day.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you guys in your jobs have heard people talk about, you just kind of go to the corner and you kind of just watch what's happening, but you're not really there. That was a lot of it. I was up in the corner and I could kind of see what was happening, but I couldn't feel it. I wasn't actively participating. I was just
there. Just laying there.
Just there.
Yeah.
You get married to your first, your husband at 17. Did you ever open up to him?
Never
said a word. You said the first time he opened up was 35. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm being redundant.
No. Now I was still married to him at 35.
You were.
So, yes. And my mental illness spun out of control when I spoke those words about my dad.
Well, so before that, there had to be a reason why you said, I got to unburden myself. Were you going to therapy? Were you going?
No, actually, I went to lunch with a friend. And my friend said to me, completely out of the blue, Sherry, I know about your dad. Now, to this day, I don't know how, I need to circle back and find that missing piece. And so we talked about it. I cried, she cried, and then we made a pinky swear to never talk about it again. And that was when I left that restaurant that day, that was my plan, to never talk about it again. Except when I tried to put the pieces back in the box and put the lid on, the lid wouldn't go.
You opened up Pandora's box.
And I started spinning out of control, and I knew I was going to have to get in therapy quick or I wasn't going to make it. So I had to tell my children's father, because he had to know where I was. And I got started in therapy, and it got a lot worse before it began to get better. And he didn't understand my mental illness, and my marriage dissolved.
Did he understand the incest part?
He knew.
But he didn't really grasp it?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
So the only way that this friend could have known about your father is if she experienced it or somebody else experienced it. So apparently your father has done this multiple.
My guess is, if I just had to pick a number, wild ass guess, I'd say no less than 25 people that my father perpetrated. That's just a guess.
Yeah. You know what? It's like they go out of this playbook. They find this playbook. And it seems like every time I hear something like this, it is the same movie that plays.
Yeah. No kidding.
And nobody knows, you know, I thought I was the only one, and every other victim of every other sexual assault thinks they're the only one. And until I was 35, well, actually, I didn't start even talking about it until I was about 50. I truly believed I was the only one. I did not know that there was another living person in the world like me.
And that could live through that travesty that you lived through.
And because of the way you were groomed all those years, thinking you're the only one actually added to the fact that there's got to be something wrong with me. I'm the only one that's this done. So it's got to be, I'm the common denominator in all this. So it's got to be me.
And if at one point I started running away in high school and law enforcement would find me and take me home and my dad would be waiting on the porch and they would see my dad, and everybody in town knew my dad. And they'd say, "Hey, Sherry, there's your dad. Tell your dad I said hi." But they never asked me why I was running. So when I'm working with law enforcement, it's really important that I try to remind them, you know, if you're working with somebody that's running away, we're not running to something. If you can figure out what's behind us, that's, we're running from something. Yeah. We're not running to something.
And you have no safe space. You have no.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You didn't have any like place where you could just feel comfortable and be yourself.
When I was in Kansas, when the times that I was there, my grandmother lived maybe 30 minutes from me, and she was a safe place for me. She didn't know, but at her house, I was safe.
And that was your dad's mother?
That was my mother's mother.
Your mother's mother. Mm-hmm. So if at 35, you finally, the floodgates begin to open.
Yes, that's a really good analogy.
All right. And I know once you open that floodgate, there's no closing it anymore, no matter how much you try to twist that wheel. All right. You have some mental issues where you have to go into therapy. Oh, we're talking inpatient therapy?
No.
So you were living your life.
Trying. Yes.
And how many children do you have?
Three.
Three children. So you're a mother, you're going through this, you're reliving a super traumatic experience, and you're trying to hold it all together. Yeah, that's
trying. And then my children's father decided to opt out. And so I added that on top of everything else.
Did you blame yourself for your dissolution of your marriage?
No, I rented a little house. Things got really, really bad. And so there was a little house that became available for rent about a block from me in a really small town in Kansas. So I rented that little house for a month. I thought if I could get myself together, because everything in the world is my fault. If you fell today and stubbed your toe, I am so sorry, because that's my fault, because everything is my fault. And so I rented this little house and I thought, I'll just stay here for a month, I'll get myself together, and then I can go back to my home and back to my marriage and my children. But I didn't get a chance to go back. I had only been gone one day, and the chief of police in my town showed up at my door and served me divorce papers.
Wow. And what was his reason for getting out of the marriage?
I have no idea.
You really don't know? Mm-mm. Oh, that's odd.
We never talked about divorce.
Now, what were the kids thinking at this point?
My kids were so confused, because on the outside, we were the perfect family. Every kid in the neighborhood came, stayed at our house.
So you were kind of like Instagram.
Yeah. Or Facebook.
Yeah.
Just the highlight reels.
That's it. Just the highlight reels to the outward appearance. You're living the life of Riley. Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew.
Look at that family. They're so lucky.
We know some people like that. Yeah.
Nobody knew I was sleeping on the couch at night, I'd fold up all my bedding before the kids got up. And, you know, the outward appearance was spit shined. It was perfect.
And you.
Now, do you think that was a way of hiding your past? That, you know, you put on this big happy front?
I just wanted my kids to be happy.
Again, you're in protective mode.
Yes. I wanted them to have normalcy, whatever that was.
In some way, though, you have to think that this pain is going to end for you. You know, like when you get out of a bad situation, you bury stuff real deep, right? And I'm sure you buried this so, so deep, thinking it's just going to go away one day. It's going to dissolve, mm-hmm. like those stitches that they put inside of you. It's just going to dissolve. But the problem is, the more you bury it away, just it's like a volcano, and it just builds up pressure, mm-hmm. until one day it explodes.
Absolutely.
Did you have an explosion point?
Probably when I tried to commit suicide, but that was so much later, and it doesn't fit a pattern very well. Like, we like things to be in a pattern.
Regimented.
You said society likes things packaged.
They do. And I talk about my suicide attempt, not because I'm proud of it, because I'm certainly not, but my abuse from my father stopped when I was 17. I got a divorce when I was 40. I got remarried about 3 years later, and life was good. I was living in Kansas City. My husband took a job in Corpus Christi, Texas. And I had been there about 6 months, and he was thriving and loving it. I didn't fit in. I didn't look like anybody there. I didn't sound like anybody there. People stared at me and they would say things like, "You have colored eyes." What does that mean? What? I don't know what that means. And then I realized nobody has eyes that look like mine. Nobody has hair that looks like mine. People talk in a different language. And I have complex PTSD, which was spinning out of control. And I just decided one day that I had fought and clawed and scratched for every day of my life. And I was just tired. And here I am, 50. I'm living in a condo on the beach. Everything should be roses, but it wasn't. And so I just decided, you know what? There are things worse than dying. And for me at that point, living had become worse than dying. Now, my husband, who's very in tune with my mental health, had no idea that I was so bad, but he was doing so great at his job. And
you don't want to ruin his high.
Exactly. I didn't want to be a bother to him.
I want to give him Narcan.
So I just decided I was just done. I wasn't mad. I just was tired.
Resigned.
I was over. I didn't have anything left to give. And in this juggling all of these balls and pretending to be something that I'm not. And I just decided I was tired. And so I set out with a plan and, I knew that Gary would leave at 7:45 to go to work and he'd be home at 12:15 for lunch. I was an EMT for a long time, so I know some things and, you know, I just was done.
How were you going to do it?
I have a chronic back injury from a car wreck, so I just saved up Vicodin and saved him and saved him and saved him. I knew to be on the tile. I didn't want there to be a mess on the carpet. And, you know, I have people say, "Didn't you think about your husband?" Of course I did. And when I'm working with anybody, mainly law enforcement now, I say, "What do you think I thought?" And they all know the answer. He'd be better off. Absolutely. He'll be sad for a hot minute. But then he'll find somebody that can love the way that he loves, somebody that's not batshit crazy like I am, and he'll be so much happier. Now, that was when I was 50. I should have been over it, right? People ask me all the time, "Are you still talking about that?
Yeah.
When are you going to get over it?"
Yeah.
Well, I take 30 pills every day just to digest my food because adrenaline has dumped in my body for 60 years and my organs are breaking down. My thyroid doesn't work. My liver doesn't work. You name it, they don't work. And the thing about people like me is I have a doctor that I'm working with who's very good, but if you break your leg, they cast it. You don't put weight on it. You let it heal and then you're good to go. But for me, I'm like trying to bail out water from a boat that's still taking on water because I'm still dumping adrenaline every day. And I'm still trying to get my body to work right. And it's not, but it's better. I'm working with a really great guy. And the only way I can stop it, and you guys probably know this, is by breathing treatment. It's
Wim Hof.
Yes. And
everybody knows Wim Hof.
That doesn't, you know, it doesn't stop it, but it breaks the cycle. For as long as I'm doing that, I can stop the adrenaline cycle from dumping.
Could be a temporary relief.
Yes.
And that's really all you're looking for at this point.
Yes. It's a reset of your electrical system.
And it stops the dumping of the adrenaline. So that was, you know, if all of that stopped when you were young, why in the world when you're 50 are you trying to kill yourself?
Because eventually you can no longer run away from the prairie fire.
No matter where you go, there you are.
Correct. So I have an analogy with prairie fires. Okay. I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but so I was reading a book about how to survive worst case scenarios. I'll give you a very short version of it. And normally human instinct is to run away from danger. It's just how we're born. Well, I was reading this book and it says how to survive a prairie fire. There's no prairies in New Jersey, but I read it anyway. So if you
see, they have them in Corpus Christi.
Yeah.
In Kansas, we do prairie fires.
So if you see a prairie fire coming towards you, this big wall of flame, you're going to try to run away. But if you run away, it's growing and growing and growing until it will consume you and you're going to die. When all you have to do is run straight into the fire and you'll get through to the other side and you'll be scarred, you'll be charred, but you're going to be alive. It's kind of like trauma in our life. The more you try to run away from it, it grows and grows and grows until it consumes you. It's nothing different than a credit card bill. Okay, don't pay your credit card bill this month. Run away from it. Don't pay it next month. Run away from it. Interest, interest, interest. And it just grows and no longer can you afford even the monthly payments. So that's my theory. Okay, it's what's worked for me. When I did an about face and headed straight into the fire, that's when my journey of healing really started. And what was your moment where you turned around and started heading into the fire?
It was that morning when my suicide didn't go as planned. And I realized I'm still here.
Shit. That was my reaction. Exactly. I'm like, shit.
I can't even do that right.
When you're,
that's exactly right. I'm like, I fail at life and now I fail at death.
I'm such a failure.
The hell, Sherry.
Yeah. I know that because that is exactly what I said. Exactly. I'm like, you're a failure at life. You're a failure at death. I guess you're just a failure. They were right.
In everything. Yeah. Everything they said about you is true. It took me a minute or day or two to tell Gary I knew he'd be devastated. Not with me, but he'd be mad at himself because he didn't catch. But listen, I'm Academy Award winning actress. That's what I did for my whole life.
Yeah, I was going to say you were acting your whole life.
Yeah, it's all I know. So that after that event, I decided I'm taking my life back. And so I started a new kind of therapy. I started EMDR. And it's the craziest thing I've ever done.
Isn't it?
It's like chicken voodoo. I don't know. It's weird, but it changed my life.
It's almost like when you're doing it, you want Inagata DeVita to be playing in the background.
It's so weird.
Yeah, it is. It's very strange. And you don't realize it when you're doing it until like a couple days later. And you're like, you just sort of become introspective and you start remembering things. You start like thinking about things and a little peaceful. And so it's bizarre.
It is. And I have a great friend, Holly, who before she was not a therapist when I was doing EMDR. And I would tell her about these crazy, crazy things. Well, she is now a therapist and she does EMDR. And she said, I in my professional life, I need to call it EMDR. But all I hear is you, Sherry, calling it chicken voodoo. And that's what I want to call it. And I said, well, probably don't do that with your patients. But anyway, and that was when I decided I'm not living this life. There's more. There's something better for me. And I'm taking my power back.
The first time you got up in front of group of people and actually let go and told your story, was the reaction what you thought it was going to be?
The first time I told it was not a verbal story, which is a little odd. I was asked to do what was called a cardboard testimony. And so on the front of it, it says who you are, suicide, incest survivor, I think was the first time I'd ever written the word out, suicide survivor, incest victim, because that's what I thought it was, suicide survivor. And then on the back, it says who you're striving to be. So I couldn't even say the word incest. It made me want to throw up in the back of my throat. So then a little group asked me to come and educate them after I did this little cardboard testimony. And I thought, I don't know why they want me. I don't have anything to say, but I did. And then another little group in Corpus. And then about the third one, my husband, who's a brilliant businessman, said, Sherry, this is going to get bigger than you. Which I thought, that's so dumb. I don't even know what that means. And he said, I want to set you up as a nonprofit. I want you to do this right. And I said, I can't run a nonprofit. Did you forget? I'm ugly, stupid, dumb. And I can't run a nonprofit.
And your husband, if he's a husband like it, nope, I fully remember. I remember.
He said, no, maybe you can't, but I can. And I'll help you. And I remember he said, the first thing you need is a board. And I was so excited because I knew I've got this one. I got this answer. I got it. And I said, okay. Do you want me to go to Lowe's or Home Depot? And he said, no, Sherry. No.
What your husband was trying to do was empower you.
And he did.
He really was trying to empower you. He's like, okay, let's make lemonade out of lemons. This happened. Can't change it. Can't unring that bell. But we can use this to make yourself better and who you really want to be.
And he did. And I started my nonprofit.
Can we say your husband's name?
Sure, Gary.
Gary, I'll tell you what, Gary, my hat's off to you.
Yeah, okay.
You're making us all look bad, Gary. Stop.
No kidding.
You're really making us look bad. No, that's wonderful. I mean,
so I started, then I had a little college in Georgia call me and I went there. And when I was at that college speaking to the student body, it's been 6 or 7 years ago now, there was a police officer waiting at the stage. And I thought, well, he needs to go on about, he needs to go unlock a door or whatever it is law enforcement does.
Did you think he had warrants out for your arrest or anything?
No, but I knew he was going to challenge me. I knew that. And so when I made it through, all the students want to talk to me and tell me their story. And he waited and he waited. And so finally I went down there and I introduced myself and he was the chief of police. And he said, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. Okay. And he said, can you come to my office? Shit. Okay. Never been to the chief of police office, but okay. And I thought, here we go. He's going to tell me everything I'm doing wrong. And he said, you said a lot of things. And he was at the time probably 62. Some things you said go against everything I learned in the academy and we teach in law enforcement. And I said, okay. And he said, I want to learn from you. And I thought, you must have fallen down and bumped your head. Because I'm dumb, stupid, uneducated. I didn't get to go to college. And so, you know, for example, he said, you don't make eye contact. And I said, you're right, I don't. And he said, but we're taught that if your person doesn't make eye contact, they're lying.
They're lying. Yep.
And so he started taking together, he and I built a class and he said, how soon can you teach my officers? I said, teach them what? And he said, everything you know. And I thought, you people are educated and smart, and I am not. But I just decided to come at it from the other side. I can't teach you from the book, but I can teach you from a victim. And so that's what I do. We built a 4-hour class. We built an 8-hour class. I'm so honored that my class is post-certified. And I go on site so they don't have to send their officers away one by one. I come in and I do all the PDs, colleges and sheriff's departments and
post-certified. Now that is, they get credits for their continuing education. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, and I found that in doing that, I don't have to sugarcoat my story. I don't have to watch my language. The door is closed and I just tell my story.
You could be yourself.
I can.
For maybe the first time in your life, you could be yourself.
Mm-hmm. And they're not offended. And they're not going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, she said a bad word.
So you let all this stuff out. How much better has your life been since you've released?
Oh, I can't even.
Is the dam that was built up behind you starting to recede?
Oh, it's almost all gone.
And all the Vicodin are gone?
All the Vicodin are gone.
Because if they're still there, just we'll talk afterwards. No.
Should have brought some.
My back injury, as soon as I'm still tense all the time. But as soon as I started letting go of that, then my back injury started becoming better because I'm not holding on to everything.
And it's the built up tension.
It is.
It's the built up tension that's making everything hurt. And
And I don't, you know, I can't change my past, but I try every day to be a better mom, and my kids and I are so close. They're grown and I have grandkids. But every time I get invited somewhere and I get to educate, and I have law enforcement tell me, Sherry, every law enforcement officer in the world needs to sit under you. Or they'll say, I will never forget you. Good.
I'll tell you straight up, I'll never forget you either now.
Thank you. They'll say to me, I have listened to you and realize how badly I screwed up my sexual assault cases. Because the first thing I ask them when I go in there, who wants to take the sexual assault cases?
Yeah.
Nobody. Hands across, arms across. Nobody wants them.
You normally I would ask you, like, if somebody else was in your shoes, what advice would you give them? Stuff like that. I'm going to change this around a little bit. You have 7-year-old Sherry sitting next to you. And you have 62-year-old Sherry's brain and her current outlook on life. What do you tell 7-year-old Sherry?
I've had to go back and do that. I've had to go back and find her and make peace. listen, there's enough blame to go around, but it doesn't belong to her. You can't at 7 years old be your father's wife and try to go to school every day and try to hide.
And your brother and sister's protector.
My mother's protector. I was my mother's mother. And I carried the weight of the world. And the fact that I came out the other side is truly unbelievable when I stop and look back from where I've been. And
miracles do happen.
And what I know now is that I love life. And my voice is loud and boisterous, and my laugh is loud and obnoxious, and I don't care because I love life. And I spent the majority of life trying to run from it and hide it. And so I just embrace every single day, and I just want to help because I admire law enforcement so much. If I can help you guys do your job a little bit better, then I'm absolutely elated.
Temper your admiration for us, because not all of us are good. Most of us are good, but some of us.
You never knew Kevin when he was a cop.
So where can our audience find you?
Corpus Christi, Texas. No, you can find me.
At 739 Mockingbird Lane.
I have a website, sherryalsop.com. The name of my nonprofit, it's a 501c3, is Courage Starts With You. Took me a long time to come up with a name. And when my chief of police, who retired, and I'm still mad because I lost my partner. When I was trying to think of a name for my nonprofit, I was driving back from Atlanta or from where I was to Atlanta. And I thought, man, that took a lot of courage for that person, that educated person, to come to me and ask me to help him do his job better. And it took a lot of courage for me to tell my story. And I realized it starts with each and every one of us. Courage started with me when I tell my story, because only 7% of incest survivors go on to tell their story. Because
we're 7%?
Seven.
Wow.
And the average age for disclosure is 53.
Holy shit.
We live our life in such bondage because we don't know how to get out. So my advice to anyone that's listening is don't wait till you're 53. There's an amazing life on the other side.
We're coming to the end of this thing. And wow.
Can I answer your question? You can find me on Facebook. You can find me.
Well, usually on the website, there's all jumping off points. You can find all the social media on there. And we're going to put links in our show notes. You have lived every child's nightmare and every good parent's nightmare. You have lived it.
And really, if you think about it, every daughter's nightmare. But it was at the hands of your father. I mean,
there's so many different dynamics here, but it's a bad situation. But it's had to. I know it's taught you something. So what do you think your suffering has taught you?
To look for the good. Whatever life has dealt you. You know, I can't tell someone that's lost a child. I can't say to them, I understand, because I don't.
Because
I've never lost a child. But.
Yeah, you did. You lost little Sherry when she was 7 years old. Yeah.
Yes. But use your life experiences as a torch and light the next person's light. Because if you'll do that, then we one by one, we can begin to heal and make the world a better place.
We'll make that thin house of cards fall. I can't thank you enough for coming in here. It was hard for me to hear. But it was necessary.
It's a hard topic, but
it's necessary.
But there's life and there's joy and there's laughter. And that's what I want people to know.
I appreciate you.
Sherry, you are an incredible person. You really are.
Thank you.
I am so, so touched that you're still here today.
Very honored to know you.
Yes, absolutely.
You're a survivor. And I can't wait to see what you do in the future.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, you guys.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of Incest with Sherry Alsop. And let's think about all the stuff that we learned. Putting down roots is essential for children. Society likes things packaged. Some people don't deserve to have kids. Get triggered. Get better. Run towards the fire. But most importantly, love life. And always look for the good.
Always.
And that's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget to go to our sponsor, the Oakley Kitchen, on what's it, 789 Bloomfield Avenue in Nutley. Go to popple.com for a digital business card. Put in the code TSP20 for a 20% discount. Follow us on all social media. That's LinkedIn, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram.
OnlyFans.
Follow Mike at Mike_Fillets. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. And we'll see you on the next episode.